target demographic match to my speaking capabilities over here in the corner. So I think the title is self-explanatory. I'm going to be talking about paraphrasing, and I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about it during the course of today with Sandra Harbajo and Dan Moldovan talking about similar related issues. But just to give some motivation, what I'm really interested in and what I've always been interested in is the question of how we can create applications that appear to understand natural language. And of course, emphasis on appear, because I don't think we're really going to create software that understands. So we need to fake it as best we can. So how do we fake that? And how do we fake it without, first of all, anticipating all the inputs that a user might give us in advance, you know, just enumerating them all and specifying some output, which is clearly hopeless. Or hand coding patterns, for example, if we want to answer where questions or when questions, and we might want to specify patterns that anticipate the kinds of answers we're looking for. Again, that's a very large task. We'd rather not have to do it. And also, if possible, we'd like to avoid tagging massive amounts of data for supervised learning. It's expensive to tag data, difficult, you get in fights over what the tagging specification should be, and so on. So we'd really like to avoid all of this. And that's a tall order, of course. And one kind of problem motivating this, again, I'm sure you'll be hearing a lot more about this today, is a question like this. If somebody wants to ask a search engine a question like, who's John Lennon's widow? Well, that sentence about Yoko Ono answers that question in that it refers to her late husband, John Lennon. But it doesn't do so in a way that's really straightforward for us to get at with keywords, for example. And I just wanted to throw this quote up, which I read with a sense of shock and guilt when I first read it a year ago. And this is from Danny Sullivan, who's a critic. Guru who talks about search engine technology out there. He's got a website called Search Engine Watch. And he issued this pretty scathing indictment of natural language processing technology as applied to search over the years. He says that, well, I'll let you read it, but I've seen the pitch time and time again, and he has what he refers to as a screen, a list of press announcements over the years that have purported to be the next big thing. You know, natural language processing technology is just about to revolutionize the search world. And, you know, he charts the progress of that press release year after year after year after year, and then points out that, well, we're still dealing with keywords. And, I mean, I know I'm guilty of doing exactly this. Back in 1998, we released a version of Encarta, which was Microsoft's encyclopedia, which has been trounced now by Wikipedia. But we had some natural language processing technology in there aimed at question answering, and we did some complex work too with syntactic analysis, morphological analysis, and a little bit of paraphrase recognition as well. And we did all this work, we shipped it with the product, and I remember when the marketing people came around and said, how do we market this? Give us some examples to market it with. I spent a long time playing with the technology and the encyclopedia, trying to find examples that really, really showed the benefit of all this work we'd done on natural language processing. And I came up with a couple of examples, like a pair of questions, what insects eat animals versus what animals eat insects. And you could show that by using this technology, you could distinguish articles that showed animals eating insects versus insects eating animals. It was a nice marketing pitch. And I've seen those same questions used again by other companies making the same kind of pitch. So that depresses me. But so that last quote, every time I hear somebody say that they have natural language revolutionary technology, my eyes start to glaze over. Well, is he being fair? I mean, it's a very harsh assessment of the technology and its impact on natural language search. But is it fair? And well, I think first of all, you have to qualify and say, what do you mean by natural language processing technology? And clearly, some NLP technologies have had significant impact on search. Things like word breaking, morphological analysis, language identification. Should this page be indexed as a Greek page or an English page? You know, those are all, in one form or another, natural language processing technology. And they all have, I think, critical impact on search. Another area that I think qualifies as NLP and that has had significant impact on search is statistical classifiers trained on lexical features. And I just wanted to show you a little demo here. So Microsoft has a search engine. Anybody isn't aware of that? I think many people are not aware of that. And they're trying to do better. And one thing that my group just put out, I think, is for me one of the only reasons I would go to live search right now, and suddenly it's a compelling reason for me to go to this site. This is a feature called Opinion Index. If we go and we look for a product on live search, say iPod, you get a list here of different iPod models. If you click here, say on the Nano, now you see a list of user reviews scraped from various sites on the web. So Price Grabber, if we went down, you'd see Opinions, other sites like that with user reviews. And over here, we've got a nice summary of positive or negative sentiment on particular features. And these particular features are pre-specified. So what's going on here is sentiment classification. So at a sentence level in each of these reviews, a statistical classifier is making a decision for each of these pre-specified features that are relevant to users who are shopping. Is this sentence that seems to be saying something about this feature expressing a positive sentiment or a negative sentiment? And for example, we can drill down and look up, I don't know, something like, I looked at screen before, let's look at screen. And here are individual sentences coming from all these different reviews. Here's an Opinion, searchreviews.ebay.com, and so on. And in most cases, I think it has accurately picked out sentences that say something about the screen. So color screen, I guess not necessarily positive. Screen, colorful screen for this thing is a perfect thing. Vibrant, colorful screen. You'll see some errors because it is, of course, automated.
It's the errors you don't see, the false negatives. That's
yeah.
The problem, not necessarily.
Right, but there's a lot of information out there. It doesn't really matter if you miss it. You know, there's a lot of redundancy. So as long as you're providing some useful information. And I think this is pretty accurate often. I mean, if you want to play around with it. Right now, it's let's find something that has more. Customer support looks very negative for everything. Everybody seems to hate it. I don't know. Anyway, I won't drill down on this. You can go to it yourself. It's just live.com. And if you search for any consumer electronic product, or I think women's clothing is the other category that they've done, but I'm not sure.
I just have a quick question. On your first slide, you said you want to do this all without manual annotation.
That's what I was going to say. Exactly.
Okay,
and this
so
is exactly. So this is trained on tech data.
Okay.
Yes. So this is certainly not the holy grail that I would like to achieve. And I won't go into this, but essentially these are just statistical classifiers, whatever classifier you like. I think it was implemented with Bayesian classifiers. Pretty simple stuff. You know, this is trained on human tag data, human supervised data, where people have gone and annotated at the sentence level for each of these pre-specified features, which sentences are positive, which are negative, and then the classifier is learning words and phrases that are correlated with positive or negative sentiment. The overall effect is pretty good, though. But you know, it raises this question: why are we still, even though you're creating something that does appear to understand language, at least in a simple way, why are we still relying on keywords? So, what about the deep NLP techniques that are, I think, really what Danny Sullivan was talking about? Syntactic analysis, semantic analysis, really trying to get at the semantics of sentences and paragraphs and whole discourses. Where are they in this whole search problem? And I think the answer is that this really has proven elusive over the years. Oh, it's driving you crazy.
Driving me crazy. Because somebody looking at the previous screen where you're displaying this really negative customer support, the first thing I want to ask is, aren't there any music players that have positive customer support, and you have to interpret that with relation to what the user's looking at that moment, and be able to realize that the user's asking about things that the system, that isn't part of the conversation.
You could certainly index the information in that way if you wanted to.
Right. You can do anything the problem, this is the same problem that's been happening with AI. As soon as you can do something, it's no longer AI. And as soon as you can do something, it's no longer semantics.
Exactly. No, I that point is well taken. That as soon as it's not magical anymore, it's, yeah, right, exactly. It's not NLP anymore either, yes. No, I agree with that. But let me show you. Okay, so I do think that Danny Sullivan has a point, though, that there has been an awful lot of hype around the more sophisticated technologies. And even though what I just showed you may appear to understand language, it's really keyword-based, I think. So at least to me, I came here as a graduate student many years ago in the linguistics department. So it's not deeply satisfying to me that we're still so reliant on keyword techniques. And I just wanted to say a bit about the traditional approach to NLP is very much motivated by, I think, linguistic factors, where the idea has been to build all of these components that mirror the kind of information that we're taught in linguistics classes, like a syntactic parser, a dependency analysis of some kind, so on. And the assumption, at least certainly when I started at Microsoft, this was our goal in the 1990s, to build that Uber system that for a whole range of languages would do the full natural language processing analysis. And once you got to that nirvana of a system that could do that with 90 or 95% accuracy, the applications would just fall out. That you would not have any problem building these complex applications that seem to understand language. But really that hasn't been the case. So people, it's not completely clear whether that's because we haven't been able to achieve the level of accuracy needed in the different component technologies. You could argue that, well, it's because there are, you know, syntactic parsers are at only 85% accuracy, and you need 95 before that will happen. I, myself, with a lot of experience in this area, feel that it's a more fundamental problem, that it's not that, that even if we had perfect technology in each of these components, the applications wouldn't flow from them. And that's because I think we were going about it the wrong way. So if you ask, what do applications actually need? Applications like this, starting with information retrieval, but also things like dialogue, if you're trying to talk to your computer or trying to summarize, what do they need? And I think the answer is that they don't need a word sense, they don't need a parse tree, they don't need discourse structure. Instead, they need something much more abstract and simpler, and you'll be hearing about this more today, but I think they need to know when two strings that are superficially different from one another at some reasonable level mean the same thing, or whether one can be inferred from the other. So that's what this is. So if one entails the other, you can infer one from the other. I think some applications also need the ability to generate a string that preserves the meaning of the original, but is superficially different from it. I'll say a bit more on that. And so just in general, I just want to refer to those as empirical models of semantic overlap. I think that's really what we need. And I'm not trying to argue that some of these levels of analysis aren't relevant to computing these models of semantic overlap. I think actually they are. I think you may need a lot of linguistic information to do a good job of this, but that really what the applications need is not any of these lower level features. These are just features that might contribute to a modeling technique. And let me just refer again back to my own history in this area, because I certainly came at this from a very AI perspective, a very knowledge-intensive linguistic perspective. And I think my own hard experience in this area might save people a bit of trouble, because I look around the field today and I see people doing some of the same things that we tried in the 90s, and let me just describe it. So we spent a lot of time at Microsoft building a resource that we called MindNet, which was really cool. It was a thing of beauty. The goal was to take text, regard text as a meaning representation, and process that text to derive rich structured knowledge from it. And we did that by creating a detailed dependency graph for each sentence in a corpus. So who's doing what to whom, when, where, that sort of thing. And we would take that sentence, which was now mapped into a graph. We would take all the other sentences in the corpus mapped into graphs, and we'd aggregate them. We'd overlap those graphs where they shared nodes, which were words, or in some cases, short phrases. So we would build a large dependency graph, an arbitrarily large dependency graph out of the corpus. And that was our representation of the meaning of that corpus. You know, no discourse structure, but sentence level information. And within there, we had a lot of complex processing going on. Again, there were errors, but named entities, so name states, etc. We had morphological processing. We were able to deal with temporal expressions, that sort of thing. And we did some fairly rudimentary, but somewhat effective, information retrieval-based weighting of subparts of that graph to try to favor bits of the graph that appeared to be correct. So we would try to downweight, for example, graph fragments that were either very frequent, because they were sort of the equivalent of stop words, or very infrequent on the assumption that they were probably errors, parse errors. So we tried to favor middle frequency information. And we had a bunch of path exploration algorithms, including a learned similarity function at the lexical level. Let me see, where is it? I'll just show you a bit of this. So, here, for example, was, can you see that at all?
Mm-hmm.
I think I can make the font bigger. No, I didn't do anything. Oh well. Anyway, I won't go through it, but basically this says a Python has as its hypernym, is a type of snake, modified by the classifier type with an operator hanging off its several. So it's, and that dependency graph, the details don't really matter here, but that dependency graph was derived from a dictionary entry, any of several types of large, non-poisonous tropical snakes that kill small animals, blah, blah, blah. So one of the attributes hanging off this was an attribute relationship, for example, Python. It is a snake. Snake modified by tropical, non-poisonous, large, and this old clausal element. It's a snake that kills animals, so on, in a particular manner. So there was a lot of very highly structured information here. And we could then explore this graph with techniques like, for example, Python and Prey. There, I think you can see. So Python is a snake, and one of its attributes is that it coils around, and we weren't mapping this preposition to anything more abstract, coils around prey, so on. Or Python is a snake, and it has this attribute that it suffocates the object, prey. And these, again, come straight from dictionary definitions, which are a very rich source of prototypical information like this. So any of various non-venomous snakes of the family Pythonidae, found chiefly in Asia, Africa, and Australia, that coil around and suffocate their prey. So on. So you can imagine that if you do this on a grand scale, you start to get some pretty interesting information emerge from this. So suffocating is the purpose, squeezing has its purpose suffocating or choking, for example. The purpose of squeezing can be to suffocate or choke. Anyway, you get the idea. There was a lot of very richly structured information here. And the general idea was that we were building something like this with weights on it. And the weights could have been much more sophisticated than they were if we'd spent more time on that thing. And this is what I just showed. We can find paths through here. We can identify similarity relations, for example, based on the way we had a learned similarity metric that involved taking pairs of words from a thesaurus, finding the types of paths that link them in this network, and then turning around and saying, if you're this type of path, you represent similarity between these two nodes with this level of probability, and so on. Then, six or seven years ago, we decided, okay, this is mature enough. I think it's time for us to try the experiment that we've been aiming for. Let's do question answering with this. So we built a mind net out of text of a bunch of dictionaries. And in this case, again, Microsoft Encarta, because it was a nice target corpus for question answering, lots of information in it. We went ahead and would then take, we actually had a very interesting hand tagging effort done where we collected a lot of questions from school kids. Encarta did a lot of work with school kids. We collected hundreds of questions from 12-year-old kids. We then had a research librarian go in and create the full recall set for each of those questions in Encarta. So by the end of this, you know, 6-month project work, she knew everything in that encyclopedia. You could ask her any question and she could tell you exactly where it was. And so she created a set telling us exactly where the answers were in Encarta, whether they were a close linguistic match to the input, whether they were a good answer or not. And then we went ahead and tried a graph matching approach. We took a question, took these questions, we built the dependency graph from the question, and then we essentially just threw it at this network to see where it stuck. And we allowed some heuristic fuzzy matching. So we did a little bit of sliding around, for example, on the synonymy scale, if we found a structural match, but the words didn't match, we could look and see whether those words might be similar to one another. If so, we'd let them match with some heuristic degree of probability. And obviously, we allowed WH words to match against appropriate named entities and so forth. And we also did a bit of common sense reasoning, doing a little bit of math reasoning, so on. This is work I did with Arul Menezes. And then we did something that was really cool, and that I don't think anybody's even tried since, which is that we could, because we had this full natural language processing system that included a very robust generation component for English, when we matched a subgraph in this network, we could toss it over to the generation component and say, here, give me an English string that corresponds to this subgraph. And the result was that we could generate back answers that never occurred in the corpus. So if we were able to match a subgraph in there, pass it on to generation, and that generation component would produce a well-formed English string from it that was a sentence. So here's just a schematic view of it. We take that input logical form, we, you know, this dependency graph for who assassinated Abraham Lincoln. We try to find a match in the corpus, but in the big mind net, this big dependency graph over here. And we might, for example, find John Wilkes Booth with an intervening relative clause, which, of course, in the dependency structure, these two elements are going to be adjacent. So the subject and the verb are adjacent. We don't have to worry about that intervening material because we've abstracted away from the string. And we can go ahead and do a match. So we find this bit of subgraph and generate back a string that didn't occur in the corpus. Well-formed answer. And it worked beautifully, just not very often. And most of the time, this whole approach failed to produce any answer at all, even when everything was perfect, even when we knew from our research librarian that the answer was sitting there in the corpus, that it was a good answer, and we could go in and look and see, well, the dependency analysis worked for the question, it worked on the answer side, which, of course, was not always the case, but often it was, and we still didn't produce anything useful. And, you know, as
why didn't it work?
Well, that's what I was going to say. We were kind of horrified because our whole lives since infancy had been devoted to building this thing. And it was, we were all very proud of it, and we were sure, we had faith that it was going to work, and it didn't. So we started to look more closely at it, and this won't be a surprise to you, but what we were trying to do was find an isomorphic match, a pretty close structural match of the question against the data set. And often, maybe most of the time, that's just not how the data works. Often the query and answer, even when there's an exact answer in there, it's just phrased in a way that is fundamentally different from the question. And then you can't match them. So again, this is a slide I stole from Ida the Gun, but so one typical situation that you're dealing with is ambiguity where one word or one sentence might have multiple meanings, depending on your interpretation. But equally common is the situation where you have one meaning and different ways of expressing it. And that's what we were up against here, that most of the time when we were trying to answer these questions, the answers were just phrased in very different ways. Simple often, but very different. So again, back to this example, who was John Lennon's widow? Her late husband, John Lennon, doesn't match in any straightforward way against widow. So having a traditional linguistic analysis here, whether it's correct or not, doesn't really matter. It doesn't get you what you need to match that question to that answer. And that situation was rife in this data set. And we had hundreds of questions, thousands of possible question-answer pairs, and most of the time it didn't work. So I alluded to this earlier, but one way to address this problem, and people have certainly done this in the area of question answering, is to try to enumerate all the anticipated variants in advance. So this is Eric Brill, did some work on question answering. Jimmy, were you involved in that? Yeah, okay. So try to anticipate all the ways that the answer might be phrased and throw in some keywords or key phrases that are going to help you. And of course, that can do a nice job for certain kinds of fixed questions, I think. But I think it opens up the potential to just keep enumerating more and more of these paraphrase relationships, in effect. And that is a slippery slope. We tried to go down that. When we had our initial failure with this MindNet experiment, we started doing this kind of thing. And it was clear that it was just a never-ending task. You know, I think you just really can't go down that path because it would drive you crazy. Yeah, sure.
Don't you think in some ways that there are less resources and the glosses in in dictionaries indicate, so linguists would call this presupposition relation.
Sure.
And so it's a pretty well defined relation. It's not an arbitrary relation between things. And it's just something that can be recorded. And so the question
sure,
is.
Sure, you could, for any one of these, I think you can
yeah.
record it. The issue is just the volume.
Right.
It's not, I don't think the issue arises with any particular one. You can just.
Yeah, no, I agree that there's, I don't know where we are on that curve where you get a lot here. It could be just anything involving language. It's just.
Well, you know, I think this is a question for Dan and Senator later, too, because I think they have much more direct experience trying to do exactly this, and Jimmy probably, too, than I do. I mean, my own experience is sort of limited to trying to do this and deciding I would spend the rest of my life doing it and still not succeed. And anyway, so to me, this raises this question of, if this is true, and it seemed to be true, and this situation was rife in our data set, so why does information retrieval work at all? And it kind of works. I mean, you can kind of find what you want. And I think the answer is, you know, so pretty obvious that the web is just so fast that the redundancy that you find out there solves this paraphrase problem for you in a brute force way. So somewhere out there, it's likely that and you were referring to this earlier, it may not, somewhere out there, somebody has likely used the same keywords, the same phrasing that you did in asking your question to answer it. And that doesn't mean that you're always going to get the optimal result. To get the optimal result, people who are good at web searching are really good at anticipating the ways that the answer might be phrased and new quoted strings to try to capture that.
And just a quick comment, it's getting even better with query suggestion, because now they'll actually deliver you the terms that actually
right.
that actually are good and give
right.
good results.
Right, based on clustering
yeah.
of
mm-hmm.
other people's questions, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I was just going to show you back to, well, we'll anticipate this later, but actually I put these out of order. Maybe this isn't a good one right now. But why don't I skip this for now? Just say that even on the web, I think we don't really want to have to rely on brute force. And you're right, the query suggestion may be a good way to do it, but it's still keyword based. And you know, I think it still doesn't address this big holy grail of how do you dialogue? How do you do summarization on a grand scale? Maybe people are satisfied with the keyword model of web search, but I don't think so in the long term. And I think especially as search goes mobile over cell phones, something more like real question answering is going to become a bigger issue on the web. You know, it's going to be harder to do keyword searches. You really want to be able to come up with a pithy answer. So you may miss many or most of the relevant documents if you use the wrong keywords. And again, for many applications, even for search, we don't have web scale redundancy to save us. So if you're trying to search on an intranet, for example, you really can't rely on redundancy to solve the problem for you. It's likely that if the answer is there at all on your intranet, it's only there once. You better get the right keywords. Again, back to this question, I want to argue that what we really need are these empirical techniques for modeling paraphrase and entailment relationships between chunks of text. And let me just show you these slides. I don't know if you saw this news story. I'm not insane. A year or two ago, there was this news story that caught my eye, which happened in the Everglades, where I just want to use this.
Can you go back to the picture?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Try to reinterpret what we're seeing there.
Okay, so this is a real news story. I'm not making this up. But I went ahead and this is the first sentence from a news article about that incident. Here's another first sentence from another news article in the same cluster of news articles that day. And another, and another, and another, and another. And what I want to use these sentences to do is to make the point that even in this very simple situation, people use very different words to refer to what's happening here. So the fact that the snake was really big is expressed in various different ways here. The fact that it exploded, I don't know if you can read that, is expressed in really, I think, interesting ways. So in some cases it exploded. Here its stomach ruptured. Here it burst. It was in Florida. So depending, I think, often with news articles, they're localized in different ways. If it's a Florida newspaper, it will be very specific about where this was. If it's a French newspaper, it will say in the US, and so on. I think this one's really interesting. So the fact that it tried to swallow without chewing, is expressed in kind of complex ways. Tried to swallow X whole, trying to snack on, which somehow captures the fact that it didn't succeed in snacking on, I guess. Scarfed down, managed to devour, tried to swallow X whole. Anyway, fairly big alligator game. And I like this one, I think, the best. So that nobody's quite sure what happened. So are baffled, are puzzling over, not all of it, still aren't quite sure how, and apparently that's a very pithy way of saying what some people took a lot more verbiage to say. But the point is just that even in this very fairly straightforward set of facts, I guess, you get tremendous variation in what people, and scientists, okay, how people express it. And so how is this relevant for applications? Well, let me look at another application here. Let's look again at questions.
You don't want to say anything about the fact that those aren't actually consistent, where some of the things said that they...
That they're not consistent and that they disagree with one another?
Swallowing it, and the other said that it didn't?
Well, in a way they're consistent. It apparently succeeded in swallowing it just before it burst. So I think in a way they're all consistent, aren't they?
Well, some say trying to swallow, and one says manage to devour, and then there's others that are non-committal.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about that. I mean, there's no such thing as synonymy or paraphrase, really. There's that. If two things are expressed using different words in different order, they don't mean the same thing. So at some point, you have to agree on some common sense notion of meaning the same thing or entailment. And this has been an issue in basically this whole area, so these entailment competitions. You have to agree some sort of common sense, real world definition. If you can get sufficient inter-rater agreement among annotators, that's good enough for me. And what I've found is that when we've paid people to annotate this sort of data, we do get pretty good Kappa scores. I don't remember what they are, but we get pretty good Kappa scores in terms of people with some very simple tagging guidelines, not a 50-page spec or anything, more like a one-page spec. People are pretty good about saying, yeah, these two sentences express the same fundamental content, modulo a few mismatches. You know, one might say on Tuesday and the other one doesn't say that, but basically the crucial facts are the same. And that's, to me, I think the Kappa scores for entailment judgments. So can this sentence be inferred, or this chunk be inferred from this other chunk? Those are lower. So I prefer, for that reason, I prefer the paraphrase judgment test, because I think it's something that we can tag more accurately. We can measure more accurately.
Yeah,
But yeah, I don't think, in this whole area, I don't think we can ever say that two non-identical strings of words mean the same thing. So we have to back off to something that's a working definition.
And this is always on the sentence.
Sentence, at least in what I've looked at, yes. Okay, so here again, this is a similar example. So a child who lives near a petrol station is 4 times more likely to develop leukemia. Just more. So here, for example, this is much less specific than this. But you can argue about whether it means the same thing, whether those two sentences mean the same thing. But I think another common sense test is that if you were asking this question, would you be satisfied to get that back? I don't know. People might disagree on that. But it's pretty interesting to see all the different ways it's expressed. And here's just one other application that relies on a similar capability of identifying when bits of sentence material mean the same thing. What I was trying to get at here is, if you're trying to factor out redundancy, say for a task like multi-document summarization, you have a bunch of documents, you're trying to factor out all the information that's repeated and just show a user what's novel. Well, obviously, if you're going down this list progressively, this is all novel. Here, you're adding a bit of information. This is in my own estimate. Here, you're adding a bit more information that wasn't up there. And after that, I didn't see anything that I would have considered novel. But the only way you can do that, the only way you can make that decision, is by somehow deciding that all of this matches against something up there already, and you've already seen it, even though they don't look the same. So I think this is a really crucial task for a lot of applications and to this general goal of trying to look like you understand language. So the basic questions that I think need to be answered are, do two chunks of text overlap semantically? If so, what's the nature of that overlap? And I think if the field of computational linguistics made a systematic assault on these problems, as is, I think, starting to happen, it would, I think, have implications for virtually all of these hard applications that we've been struggling over for many years. So how do we approach the problem? And I should say up front that I don't have a solution. So I'm not going to give you one, really, by the end of this talk. Maybe you can give me one. But one thing that has happened over the last couple of years is that a number of people in the field have come together to try to address this problem with a couple of related research threads. So first of all, this task that's emerged of modeling semantic entailment, where we now have a shared task, people trying to build systems that are able to recognize when one chunk of text is inferable from the other and try to do as well as human judges have been able to do on that task. And a similar related task of recognizing and in some cases generating paraphrase relationships. So here's just a quick example of the distinction between these two. So in one case you've got unidirectional entailment, where you say this, it entails this. You know, I shouldn't get into too much detail here because these terms are actually very fraught. This whole term of entailment is in some ways an unfortunate choice of keyword to be using here. But I just want to make this basic distinction that these two are not paraphrases, but one is, in common sense terms, inferable from the other. These are arguably the same in meaning, roughly the same in meaning. And over the last couple of years, the entailment task has been addressed in a series of challenges, and Dan and Sanda have done spectacularly well in these challenges. I'm sure you'll be hearing more about them later. And in fact, maybe I don't have too much time. I might just skip through this and assume that you guys are going to talk about it later. Is that the case? You'll be talking about it. Why don't I skip this so I can get on to other things? Okay, and I just want to say, so in natural language processing, what is working? So I said before that traditional levels of linguistic analysis haven't had a lot of impact on the field, on applications, but what has? And I think at a high level, what's been working for people in the field of natural language processing is an approach that starts with a corpus that characterizes a mapping that's of interest in some way, whether that's a mapping between strings and hand-annotated parse trees, or between two strings, for example, a string in English and a string in Japanese, and trying to model the relationship between those two. Try to induce some model that will allow you to now generate mappings of that kind. And these successes over the last 15 years or so, where there's been this big empirical revolution in the field, this reaction to the more hand-coded approaches of the past, has been toward these empirical data-driven techniques, statistical pattern learning, and yet, in the last couple of years, the pendulum has started to swing back a bit, and this is what I was referring to earlier, that instead of simply relying on statistical models on strings, more and more you're seeing modeling techniques that rely on not just statistics, but that derive their features from deeper linguistic tagging of some sort, hopefully automated tagging. But for example, in machine translation, statistical machine translation, you're seeing a real increase. The top systems are now relying on, at least in part, on syntactic information. And I think that trend is going to continue. So we won't be moving away from empirical models, but I think more and more it's feature identification. It's deciding which features are relevant that matters.
So,
and there are a lot of interesting features in the linguistic area.
What do you mean by the last?
Just that another thing that has changed in the field over the last 15 years or so is that techniques have become much more driven by hard evaluation criteria, for good or bad. You know, for example, in machine translation, there are automated scoring techniques. There's a score that's not widely admired, but it's still widely accepted, a scoring technique called Blue, which everyone lives or dies by. You know, if you can, it's essentially a model, a measure of how well the n-grams produced by your machine translation system match against n-grams from a reference corpus that has been hand-translated. So do you get a lot of overlap in n-grams and strings of words produced by your system when compared to the human reference set, or do you get a smaller?
Are people pretty happy with those?
People aren't happy. The analogy that you hear people use, it's useful, it's not good. The analogy that you hear people use is that, or that I've heard people use, is that it's like you're trying to get from Los Angeles to New York with a compass that's not very good. You know, it doesn't point to true north, it's off by some random factor every time you use it. So if you're in LA, it's still useful in getting into New York because it's not completely wrong. You're sort of going in the right direction. If you're in Philadelphia, it's useless. But you know, the state of translation right now is more like Mindanao or something. I don't know. We're not in LA yet. So it's not a good metric, but it's still proven useful. People are able to make progress with it, I think. We need better ones. But still, just having a metric, having an agreed upon metric has helped, I think, drive the field in a useful direction. And again, this emphasis on empirical modeling, on empirical metrics, is a departure from earlier AI-oriented approaches. And what's disturbing, again, to somebody like me who comes from a linguistic background, is that data-driven machine translation is just pattern matching. But if you look at the results, it's better. If you have the right parallel training data, you can build, using statistical techniques, a better machine translation system than you can starting from scratch. And there is a non-existence proof demonstrating that, I think, where people have been working on machine translation for many years.
So isn't there a sort of, from a naive point of view, the explanation, I would agree, would just be the following. To crack a CS joke, the problem is NLP hard, right? And therefore you expect at least exponential complexity in problems of this type.
Well, you can bound the problem in various ways, and people have made approximations to bound it. So for example, in translation, one very basic approximation is that you can translate at the sentence level, which is just wrong, but everyone works within that framework.
We were trying to. But the point is that just pattern matching would avoid the type of exponential complexity and hence exponential error that you
Yes, but I think that I agree with you, but I think to get down to this level of pattern matching, we've had to make some pretty artificial assumptions about what the problem really is, just to get enough data. So if we really wanted to do translation like humans do, we would have no data to work with. So.
The problem is, again, you're redefining the problem because the pattern matching that's improving data-driven MT now is pattern matching on syntactic structures for the same reason that you were doing syntactic structures before, because the patterns are more accurate given the variation you get at the string level.
Well, I think it's directed now in a way that it wasn't before, though. I think, first of all, the syntactic features that have so far been proven useful in MT are pretty limited. You know, I think, so for example, the parsers that we built at Microsoft produce a vast number of features, really, really rich feature sets, but most of those are not useful as far as we can tell. Maybe in 10 years people will find uses for all those features, but right now it's pretty restricted. And I think unless you have some empirical basis for driving the feature set that you're trying to produce, you shouldn't be doing it. You know, we were in the same situation with the mind network that we were doing. We never knew what relations we should be trying to extract from text. Should we have a location relation at all? Should we have a location on above, location below? Unless you have an application and a clear metric that tells you, yes, adding that feature does better, or no, it does worse, you can't make those decisions in a principled way. So I think this shift, even though I would like linguistic structure to be crucial, and I think it will be, I think it's a healthy thing that we've moved to this approach where we're depending on metrics, even if they're not ideal metrics.
Yeah, I just don't think that it's as strong a contrast as you're drawing because the data-driven approach is just data-driven based on a different analysis of the data. And it should be the case that, you know, the frequency of phenomena in your problem should say that's what we should be looking at. And the syntax, which allows you to recover long distance dependencies, right, is extremely useful.
Yes, it is. Yes.
And you can't do that without.
No, and we're not. I mean, we actually do a lot of syntax in our MT work. Anyway, I just want to argue that this approach has been, I don't want to argue the point of whether linguistic features are useful within this framework, because I think they are. I think they will increasingly be useful. So I think whatever they look like, I'm agnostic, but I think they are crucial. Instead, I'm just trying to argue that this basic framework of empirical modeling techniques over a set of features, whatever they might be, is probably the right way to go about solving this more basic problem of trying to identify when chunks mean the same thing. And the reason I say that is that this approach has worked well in translation, and I think this paraphrase relationship that I'm talking about is really just a type of translation. It's really the same problem as translation. You're dealing with strings that are superficially not alike, and yet they mean the same thing. So I don't think that there's any qualitative difference between this and this versus this and this. These are from the Chinese, Korean, and Japanese articles the same day. So, yes, the character sets are different. Otherwise, you've got different words being used, different word orders being used, but that's true up here as well. So, same thing here. So, we've done some work. I'm running out of time. I better hurry up, but I'll just quickly skip through this. So, we've done some work. There's nothing too interesting in the approach here. It's just straightforward, off-the-shelf statistical machine translation, phrasal only, no linguistic modeling. Trying to modelize paraphrase normalization and generation as a translation problem. And just collect a lot of parallel monolingual data of the kind that I showed, and then just throw these off-the-shelf tools at it and see how it does. I'm just going to show you, we'll not show you that now, I think. But
I hadn't reckoned with ambiguity when they set out to use computers to translate languages.
$500,000 supercalculator, most versatile electronic brain known, translates Russian into
mathematical wizardry, a sentence in Russian is to be finished. One of the first non-numerical applications of computers.
Let me see if I can make this work. Maybe it's not worth doing this, but this is a kind of funny.
It was hyped as the solution to the Cold War obsession of keeping tabs on what the Russians were doing. Claims were made that the computer would replace most human translators.
At present, of course, you're just in the experimental stage. When you go in for full-scale production, what will the capacity be? We should be able to do about quite a modern commercial computer, about 1 to 2 million words an hour. And this would be quite an adequate speed to cope with the whole output of the Soviet Union in just a few hours computer time a week.
When do you hope to be able to achieve this speed?
If our experiments go well, then perhaps within 5 years or so.
So.
Where did you find that?
Yeah.
Ken Church gave it to me. I don't know where he found it.
Do you know who the fellow was?
Yeah. No, I have no idea. But I'm grateful to him. I need to try to make this work again. Okay, so. Okay, so I skipped you. So, I mean, it's really true, 5 years out. That's true in a bunch of other fields, speech recognition, search, everything. Back to this slide. Okay, so again, we did this experiment to try to treat monolingual paraphrase as a translation problem. And there's always this danger that if you have a successful paradigm, statistical MT, machine translation, has been very successful, at least in financial terms in the field, in driving money into natural language processing. There's always this danger that you want to reapply that everywhere, even though it doesn't fit. If you're, there's this old expression, if you're a carpenter, everything looks like a nail. And I think in this case, though, really, we are dealing, like I said earlier, we are dealing with the same problem that I think paraphrase alternations are really very much the same problem as translation. And if we can succeed in unifying the approach that we're using for both paraphrase normalization and translation, there are all kinds of benefits that accrue from that. So like I said, there are, again, not great, but established evaluation metrics. There are constantly improving modeling techniques. There's a lot of money, a lot of research going into the translation area. And there's a lot of work also going on at trying to, for example, scrape parallel data from the web in translation, English, Japanese data. And if possible, we'd like to piggyback on all the success and use all of their machinery. So is this approach feasible? Well, that's an interesting question. So statistical machine translation varies in its effectiveness, not surprisingly, based on a few factors like how much training data you have available. Obviously, if you have 20 million sentence pairs, you can do better than with 1 million. The character of the training data, obviously, the language pair, and if you're trying to translate between French and Spanish, it's easier than English, Japanese. And so from that perspective, especially this last point, you're trying to translate English to English, it should be trivial, right? What could be closer than English. So let me just show you an example of what actually happens. So here's a French sentence and an English sentence, again from a pair of news articles. This is the word alignment showing how the words in these two sentences map up, where you get very predictable alternations, articles missing on the English side that are present on the French side, heads modifiers switching on the French side in predictable ways. But now look at this English sentence, which admittedly is an active passive alternation. But it's really pretty ugly when you try to do word level alignment here. And you're getting things like, again, you've got words missing on one side that are not present, morphosyntactic alternations. You've got whole chunks mapping to a single word. And in general, which would you say looks worse? And in fact, It's true that this is an active passive alternation, which is cheating in a way because that one isn't. And yet, this is actually not at all unrepresentative of what you see when you start looking at those. The data that we looked at primarily was first sentences of articles from the same news cluster. And this is actually really typical of what you see. Even when you look at them and say, yeah, they pretty much mean the same thing, they don't look like that well-behaved French stuff unless they are clearly the same sentence with a slight editorial edit introduced at some point.
Another question, so, I mean, to what extent, I mean, obviously, those particular sentences really don't mean the same thing, right? One of them talks about combating ovarian and cancer, the other talks about halting it, which is a much stronger statement. Likewise, UK and Scots are not the same piece of information. And some of the other things you showed, I mean, as a mathematician, I feel compelled to say, you know, that a 400% increase is quintupling, right?
Absolutely.
Quintupling, and so you have mistakes that come in as well. So is it helpful to know that you're not really looking for equivalence, but you're looking for a distance metric?
Absolutely, absolutely. A distance metric is the key. And you're never going to be at 100% for the reasons we were talking about earlier. And yet, these are as close as you're going to get to 100% because these are both the summary statements describing the same article, the same press release. So, you know, somebody at a Scottish university made a press release that described this new finding, and two reporters summarized
it. As UK scientists.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So again, you're never going to find a complete paraphrase. Maybe you're never going to get beyond 85% similarity, but what you want is that similarity metric, exactly. Anyway, these are just some of the kinds of alternations that you get that are translation-like. I'm out of time, so I will just skip through quickly, but in the data that we looked at anyway, the word alignment error rate, which again is measured in a widely accepted way, was much higher in the English data than in the English-French data that we looked at. So the algorithm that we were using to do word alignment was much less accurate with the English data than with the English-French data. And those alignment problems make all the data that we were using less useful for all the tasks we were doing.
So blue is less useful for you than for...
This wasn't blue, this was alignment error rate.
Okay.
So anyway, then we went ahead and we gathered a corpus of 150,000 sentence pairs, which is very small for a statistical MT system, very small. But it was hard to get this data. Then we trained up a traditional, a standard statistical MT engine and used these models to recognize, okay, here's just another example of the kind of data that we were looking at with some interesting alternations, just clausal swaps here. So, and here's some of the output. This is the lattice of translation probabilities for individual chunks for that input sentence based on this model that we trained up and then used to generate. So given this input string, the White House announced a new policy, we weren't trying to do any rearrangements or deordering. We were just trying to decide based on this data set which words, which chunks could alternate with one another and then rank the probability of the resulting strings. So some of them were pretty interesting. But of course, this is very small, really just a pilot experiment. But for example, the White House unveiled, the Bush White House unveiled a new policy, kind of a nice alternation there. Okay, so the big problem is this question of where are you going to get the data? And I'm running over, is that it? Can I have another 5 minutes to finish up? Okay, so the big problem, I will skip through this quickly. But the difference between this paraphrase problem and machine translation is that there's a vast amount of human translated data available for, say, English-French. There's no such corpus for English-English because there's nobody whose job it is to take an English sentence and give you a different version of it. So nobody's been, in fact, if you try to pay people to do this, they can't do it. They immediately start saying, well, how many words have to be different? Does the order have to change? Whereas with translation, it's straightforward. They ask you, how much time do I have? And then based on that, they'll decide how beautiful it has to sound in the target language for, you know, how much it can still sound like English and be roughly translated into Japanese. But for paraphrasing, people just don't know how to do it. You can't pay people to do this task. There are some sources, so for example, translations of novels, multiple translations of a novel into the same language, equivalent news articles, but there's really not enough of this data, and this is the fundamental problem.
Maybe not at the sentence level, but many newspapers, for example, cover the same story.
Right.
So,
right. So
articles about.
So, and this is, I think, why it's important to try to be a close follower of what happens in machine translation, because there is work starting to go on in MT now on comparable corpus extraction. So trying to find noun phrase equivalents, for example, where you don't have full sentence equivalents. So I think if we can steal from translation, that would be good. Anyway, so I think if we did have the kind of corpus that we like, I think this would be the standard approach. I think people would be using this approach, but we don't have that corpus. And so instead, people are still relying on sort of heuristic-y approaches here with to do things like question answering. Now, I'm going to just skip some of this so I can finish up. Yeah, why don't I just finish up since I'm way over. And I just want to address this question. If we can actually do this, would we have solved any real application problems? Suppose we had a metric that allowed us to say, given this chunk and this chunk, they are similar with this degree of probability. Well, can we then turn around and ship applications based on that? For the most part, I think no. That it would be nice to have the kind of capability I was just showing, the translation generation capability. For example, Microsoft Word, it would be great to have a plagiarize this or, you know, rewrite this chunk as something else. And in that sense, maybe you could directly solve an application problem with technology like this.
Except you'd be introducing a problem for the universities.
You bet.
Exactly. Well, luckily, we're not on the cusp of that breakthrough right now, I don't think. So the universities have a while to deal with this issue. But I do think that if you had that metric, it would play a key role in a bunch of applications. It would be a key feature for example, classifiers trying to do search. It might just be one feature there. It might be an important feature, but it by itself probably wouldn't let you do question answering, for example. Just to summarize then, so I think what we really need for applications on the semantic front in natural language processing is not any of the traditional kinds of features that linguistic theory has provided, although they may be important contributors to getting us where we need to go. And instead, I think we just need this ability to empirically measure when two strings overlap at some level. And I think if we can do that reliably, then we really can start to look like we understand what people are saying to us. We can begin to fake this much more effectively than we can now in tasks like dialogue, which I think is, again, I think with the rise of mobile applications, people using their phones, that is going to be really key. There's no hard line between talking to your computer and search. Once you're doing everything over the phone, you're issuing instructions, you're asking questions, you're not just doing keyword search anymore. And when you let people start talking to their machine, their expectations go way up. They aren't happy anymore with just this brittle keyword thing. So I think there is a looming issue here. We haven't quite hit it yet because mobile applications haven't really hit their stride yet. But I think the gap between keywords and real complex language handling capability is about to become much more important than it is at the moment. And I think there is this emerging consensus that what we need is an empirical, to solve this problem, is that we need an empirical approach trained on parallel data. I think many people are moving in this direction. But where that parallel data is going to come from is still a major problem. Where are we going to get it? We can't pay anybody to create it. Maybe there are ways to tease it out of people on the web. You know, people talked a lot about the ESP game. I don't know if you've seen Luis Von Oren's image labeling game called the ESP game. It's really cool. I think a few years ago people were very, very excited that it might provide a way to to engage with users in such a way that you can get data out of them to solve all your problems of this kind, for example. If you build a game, that will give you paraphrase data. And I think in the last year or two, there's a little bit of disappointment that no one else has come out with a game that's been at all successful in doing anything like that. And I think people are realizing that there are just limits to how much you can ask users to do for you in that way, that it's probably not going to provide the solution we need. Now, maybe if you can provide users with functionality that persuades them to give you data for some reason, that's a different story. But right now, there's no easy answer to this. But I think this is the fundamental problem. If we had a lot of data, this would be a solvable problem, at least to a degree. Okay, thanks.